Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we are chatting with a PR professional who specializes in information security. Melanie Ensign currently works at Uber, but she also served as a security PR for Facebook and before that, AT&T. She drops in this week to talk about how you, yes, you, can work with the PR professionals in your organization to help tell your security story to the wider world. She also has some great tips for InfoSec pros who might be a little bit nervous about dealing with journalists. That is coming up later. In this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Julian Fay, the Chief Technology Officer of Senetas. Senetas has a long history of making Layer 2 network encryptors, but they're branching out in all sorts of ways these days. And one thing they're doing now is working on approaches to network encryption that play nicely with software-defined WAN. The days of hauling all of your network traffic back to a single choke point, those days are numbered, and Julian thinks in the near future you'll have some sort of CPE device that actually implements different types of encryption on different types of traffic crossing your border. So, Senetas has actually built the gear to make this happen, and we'll be hearing more about why a little bit later on. That's an interesting chat, that one. Networks are really changing, and so are approaches to encrypting network traffic. All of that is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we're going to start with some technical news this week, and I've seen this one bouncing around on InfoSec Twitter just everywhere over the last few days. Some really interesting research on LTE networks, on, you know, LTE wireless stuff.
Yeah, there's a research paper published by a couple of guys, Thorsten Holtz and David Ruprecht of a university in Europe, who've been working on LTE and in particular working up attacks on the radio links between the handsets and the base station. And the attack that's been getting the most attention is actually, it's really interesting. It's a man-in-the-middle attack with the ability to kind of modify internet or, you know, data traffic being transited across the radio link from the handset towards the network. And they actually do so through crypto. I've often joked that, you know, no one's hacked anything with crypto since Hitler. That's not actually the case. You know, that's a little bit trite. But in this case, they are actually doing crypto to it. They're taking advantage of the fact that on the data channel, there is encryption, but there's not actually message authentication. So you can flip some bits because of they're using AES in counter mode. So you can flip some bits such that the decrypted messages are manipulated in the same way as the ciphertext. And they're using this to adjust the destination IP address of DNS requests leaving the handset and going towards the network to then get in the middle of it by providing a malicious DNS server and then using that to kind of onwards hijack the rest of the network.
If only we had some sort of technology that makes this not so important, like TLS.
Well, of course, that's been the response from the 3GPP consortium is that, well, I mean, upper layer controls like, TLS and HTTPS everywhere and HSTS.
I mean, if you're relying on your telco to be like totally secure against man in the middle, like, you know, no one does. I mean, it's still very cool research, don't get me wrong, but you hear what I'm saying, right? That this is cool research, but I think the impact of these sort of bugs are, you know, it's not as big as it would have been 10 years ago.
No, I mean, essentially what you're doing here is taking your LTE network and doing the same thing that you could already do on a wireless hotspot, you know, with, you know, a fraction of the cost and complexity and probably, you know, much more ease. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, all of the controls we've evolved, to make using untrusted wireless safe, you know, kind of apply here. In terms of real world impact, it's not so huge, but it does, you know, really demonstrate, taking what is a fairly obscure technical choice, like the fact they chose AES-CTR instead of, you know, AES-GCM or something, and then bootstrapping that up into an actual workable solution. And they've got some really good details about how they actually did it, you know, what software stack they were using with the software-defined radios to do the, you know, to emulate the ENOB to the handset and to emulate the handset to the network. They've got all the plumbing for that, which is really cool and useful stuff to look at. They've got a couple of other tricks that they use, the other elements of the research that didn't really get as much coverage, which is kind of tying people's identities on the radio network back to who they are. And also profiling what sites they're visiting despite the encryption by using kind of metadata, the size of requests and that kind of thing.
That's interesting. Which is pretty cool work. Yeah. No, look, it really is. You know, and I'm not trying to detract from this research at all when I sort of poo-poo it a bit by mentioning things like TLS. But one thing I've noticed too is, you know, now it's sort of turned into a long career of reporting on this sort of stuff. And One thing I've noticed is when it comes to wireless standards like LTE, you know, and we saw this with sort of 3G standards, and we've seen it with, you know, various iterations of WPA, is usually you see the sort of first chinks appear in the armor, and then, you know, in 5 years from now, we'll be talking about how thoroughly ripped apart it's been. I mean, do you get that sense as well, that this could just be the first, you know, really good research into LTE, and it might inspire some other people to take a look?
And probably, yeah, it certainly gives you some tools that you could use for a bunch of other things. I mean, being able to alter the contents of packets in transit, you know, is a powerful primitive that you can use for lots of things. And so, yeah, you're right. I'm sure we'll see more work bootstrapped upon this. But then again, I mean, I think the evolution of the cell network standards has been a little different than, say, the comparison 802.11, you know, wireless standards, where, you know, there was sort of, in some cases, almost a weakening from the 3G standard up towards the LTE one in terms of how the crypto work and where it worked, and then some other aspects were changed in ways that kind of made that less important, whereas, you know, the progression of WEP through WPA was a little bit more linear in terms of the, you know, IEEE learning how to crypto, you know, in the real world using us all as beta testers, which is kind of what happened there. So,
well, I mean, yeah, I hear what you're saying about that as a primitive as well, because if, you know, if you do have a mobile browser exploit or something, you know, this would be an excellent way to direct someone completely stealthily towards that exploit, right? So that, you know, that's cool, but you could also just email them a link and tell them they've won $100.
Well, yeah, exactly. We've certainly seen your people using SMS or whatever to deliver malicious contents and links, and that's got to be a lot easier than doing it on the network. But hey, but sometimes you don't know who your target is, right? Sometimes you care about geographic area more than you care about an individual who's there. So you may not know the numbers in advance, but you know anyone who's protesting.
That's an interesting point. I mean, if you use that as like, if you don't have a selector and you, you know, turn up to a neo-Nazi rally or something and just own everyone, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, that's the same reason that, you know, stingrays, MZ catchers are used. When you want to figure out who is in a particular place, that's great. Being able to shell them on the way or get in the middle of their, you know, of their instant messaging or the, you know, their Telegram or their Twitter or whatever in a specific location, like, that's a pretty useful thing if you wanted to be a jerk with the radio waves.
So, yeah, maybe it does have some applications for the SIGINTers among us. So there we go. Now, looking at a press release here from the US SEC, they have charged a former Equifax manager with insider trading. Good stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. This guy was apparently working on the website to inform people about the breach, and then he went and got some put options on Equifax stock and made himself $75,000. He then failed to cooperate with an internal investigation, was fired, and now the SEC are charging him. And I don't know if it could be any clearer that that was insider trading. And so, yeah, he's going to have a bad time, I imagine.
Ticketmaster been having some drama. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of people were sort of bouncing this one around saying, oh, you know, isn't it amazing that Ticketmaster were first alerted to their breach by Monzo, you know, the sort of financial organization, the credit card issuer. And it's like, well, actually, that's how a lot of breaches wind up getting found out, is the card issuers actually notice a pattern of fraud. They look at, you know, places that those affected customers have shopped, and then they alert the place. So that is bog standard way for people to discover that they've had a problem. But it's turned into a bit of a bun fight, with Ticketmaster blaming some third party provider for this breach. Tell us about this, Adam.
Yeah, so the story goes that Ticketmaster had contracted a third party company called Inventor to provide like that, you know, like the fake customer service agent JavaScript pop up chat things that no one ever uses. So anyway, they had one of those so you could talk to a bot, you know, about the thing you weren't going to buy from Ticketmaster. They had a third party company providing the JavaScript that did that. It was being injected into their pages to do the little pop up thing. Ticketmaster had included this code in their payment pages as well, which the vendor of the chat pop up JavaScript thing said that they wouldn't recommend doing. And then someone had owned a server associated with this third party provider, edited the JavaScript to add scraping of the credit card details, which were then, when people went through the Ticketmaster checkout process, they had the details scraped. So Ticketmaster are kind of trying to fob the blame off onto the third party. The third party's going, hey, you didn't tell us you were going to do this. It was a terrible idea. We didn't recommend that you do it. Don't blame us. And Ticketmaster, I guess, you know, fundamentally are discovering that you can't outsource blame, which is what they're trying to do.
The other thing about the Monzo angle here is they did tell them in, like, Monzo told them in early April, and that was 2 months before they sort of copped to it. So, yeah, not a good look for Ticketmaster at the moment.
No, it's really not. And yeah, you would expect a more robust response when someone comes, a payment processor comes to you and says, or an issuer comes to you and says, hey, common, purchase analysis suggests that you are the source. The data doesn't lie. Like, what are you trying to, if you haven't found it, you just need to go look harder.
Yeah. Well, it might not have been an immediately obvious place to look, right? So you can kind of understand why there was a bit of head scratching at least.
Well, yeah, of course. But I mean, in the end, hackers don't care. The hackers got JavaScript in and stole the credit card data. And the fact that it's difficult to find, is good.
Oh, we've got another story here from CyberScoop, actually, which is, it's not really a surprise. This is not man bites dog, but I think it's worth noting. The private sector in the United States is not sharing, threat intel with the Department of Homeland Security's, threat intel sharing portal, even though that they passed, they passed enabling legislation to let companies do this. And, it's just fallen completely flat. And I can't say that I'm surprised at all. I've been in discussions with people who are in, threat sharing and stuff, and it's still very much done along trust lines, personal relationships, things like that. I mean, the idea that you can just set up a portal and it's going to get flooded with really valuable information is just not realistic.
No, and I think that does, it illustrates that there is, still a degree of distrust of sharing that information with the government, not necessarily because people don't feel that they can't, that they don't want to share their internal information. I think people are willing to share, indicators of compromise and all sorts of other useful bits of data. But as you say, the current sharing is done across existing personal relationships where those trusts are mutual. And I think that's the challenge that people have with sharing with government organizations. It tends to be a pretty one-way street where you can share lots of data with them, but you don't necessarily get a lot back. And I think the DHS and some of the people that were involved in the original legislation have been looking at the reason this isn't working is because there isn't a mutual benefit for private sector to go and actually share this information, rather than it being that they don't want to. It's just there's no, incentive for them to do so.
Now, look, staying with the US government, there's a really interesting story by Lily Hay Newman over at Wired about the DOD's, Department of Defense's very own app store. And, it's really interesting because they had this issue where they want to have an app store for government apps for government workers. Some of them are classified, some of them aren't. And, they don't want to engage with the dumpster fire that is, commonly used app store. So they created their own, and they actually looks like they're doing it right. I mean, it looks like, I got to say, that's a very strong caveat there. It looks like they're doing it right, but at least there's some interesting ideas going on here. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so this is the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which is part of the Department of Defense, has built this app store called the GeoInt App Store, where they're providing apps out to military and also private sector and related organizations, users to do whatever, provide geospatial information and solve kind of problems rapidly, for people who need their data in a particular way. The sorts of concerns that you would have normally publishing that, you couldn't publish a classified app to, the Apple App Store, for example. So they've come up with an app store that has, a bunch of built-in understanding of their problems, like in terms of apps having a related classification level, apps having a way to be billed to the departments that are using them, that kind of thing. But I think most, certainly the focus of the Wired article is on the way that they do assurance of those apps to make sure that they are, safe for people to use, that they,
That's the word that sprang to mind for me as well, is this is a high assurance app store, right? That is the perfect way to describe it.
Yeah, and the sort of the key thing that they're doing is they require the developers of the apps to submit their source code as part of the vetting process, and they run it through a bunch of user-based testing, human-led testing, but also automated review of their source code, and then they give them the output of that and then tell the developers to kind of go away and get a better score. And whether that's one of the existing commercial providers or whether they've got some other internal code auditing software tool chain, I don't know. But the cool thing is for the app vendors, they get that kind of process essentially free, right? I mean, normally you'd have to go pay, Coverity or whoever, lots and lots of money to run that kind of analysis on your code. You get to kind of submit your app, have that done, and then review the output and improve the quality of your code, which seems like a pretty good trade-off. And the intellectual property concerns are kind of mitigated by some of the, structure and contractual relationships. And overall, it just seems like a really smart model. Reading about this, I was struck that, this is what we're going to end up with out in the civilian app stores eventually.
Well, you know, I mean, I think you might be able to select your assurance level, you know, in app stores. You might be able to say, okay, just give me everything, and that gets you some types of, you know, scans of compiled binaries or whatever, right? And, you know, there's key revocation for things that are known bad. Then you can step it up. Only show me source-reviewed apps, right? I mean, it feels like that would be a sensible place for this to go. Although you do wonder if they're actually, like, you know, if they're sending the source back to the developers and, you know, they're then, you know, recompiling it and sending it back. You just sort of wonder how DoD is actually checking to make sure that the compiled binary matches the source that they think is in it.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine if it were me that you would compile the apps, that the app store would provide a build system itself and you only submit build scripts.
But that's not mentioned in the article. If it was me, I'd do it as well. But it's conspicuously absent from the article. So I'm just thinking,
Yeah, well, it's certainly a good question, and perhaps a listener can enlighten us. But yeah, I could see Apple doing this, you know, increasing the cost of submitting apps to the App Store, you know, cuts down a bunch of rubbish app spam, increases the assurance. And I can see Google going down the road of having a different level of assurance visible as a property of the app, and you can filter as you were describing. Like, I could see both of those models being taken on board, you know, by Google and by Apple to try and improve the quality of the apps. And I think, you know, if Apple has a really large scale malicious app, you know, backdoored app in the App Store, well, you know, we might see them move to this kind of approach, pretty aggressively.
Yeah,
it's a thing I could see them doing.
You do get the sense something bad needs to happen first, though, right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think the cost, obviously, you know, there's quite a lot of setup. It would be pretty disruptive. There'd be a lot of pushback. But yeah, it's the sort of thing that Apple would do, I think, you know, faced with a super high-profile app being really badly backdoored.
Now, some really interesting developments are maybe related to the OPM breach or maybe not, Adam. This is a really funny little story, this one.
Yeah, so this is a woman in Maryland pled guilty to some identity theft charges. And some of the paperwork related to this said that the identities that she had thieved were done so using data sourced from the OPM breach. And of course, some people managed to notice that and started scratching their heads because there really hasn't been any previous public discussion of the OPM data turning up anywhere. I mean, the assumption has always been the Chinese used it, nicked it to use for something, you know, hacking government contractors or blackmailing people or whatever. But yeah, this was the first, you know, kind of example of it turning up in the sort of criminal world. This then kind of got walked back.
Kind of. Well, that's the interesting part.
That's where it gets weird. So we're not really sure whether or not the OPM data was involved.
Yeah, it's just a funny one. And I would be very surprised if the OPM thing turned out to be something different. I mean, God, who knows what's happened? Maybe some of this data has been leaked about the place. I mean, you know, if you were China and you'd done this, you know, you might want to take it and give it to some fraud crews, right? Because it's going to, muddy the attribution waters sort of retrospectively, right? So that would be a cool thing to do. But I think the most likely explanation here is it's just someone's misunderstood something. But still, it's worth talking about because it is odd.
Yeah, and certainly there's a lot of government workers in Virginia and Maryland that I'm sure are concerned about what their OPM data is being used for. This one might be one to keep an eye on if you're in that neck of the woods.
The Democratic National Committee has stepped things up a little bit, Adam.
Yes, after getting rather well owned, they appear to be attempting to improve their security posture somewhat. And I'm kind of quite heartened in a way that the sorts of things that they're trying to do, trying to encourage the security of their, you know, people who work for the organization, the DNC, as well as, you know, people who support it. I'm quite actually impressed that the advice that they are giving their staff and the process they're going through seems pretty reasonable. They're having kind of like monthly meetings to kind of talk through in each individual kind of organization, part of the organization, you know, what the people are doing to secure their machines, you know, patching their stuff, updating their phones, as well as securing their accounts, you know, turning on two-factor everywhere, using a password safe, not reusing passwords, all actual useful, good advice.
Well, the chief security officer for the DNC is Bob Lord, who left Rapid 7, I think, left Rapid 7 to take up that position. And prior to that, he was CISO at Twitter, and prior to that, CISO at Yahoo. So he is experienced.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, is pretty clear that experience is rubbing off because, yeah, it seems pretty sensible. And, I'm sure the, anyone who wants to hack the DNC this time around is going to have a slightly harder road to follow. Slightly.
Turning our attention now to a story by Joe Cox over at Vice Motherboard. And it turns out you know, what does the world come to, Adam? It turns out you can't trust money launderers on the dark web. Digital money launderers, e-money launderers, if you will.
Yes, it turns out investigators from ICE, which has been getting bad press lately, they've been picking up drug dealers on the dark web by running money laundering services. Turns out they're getting money out of the Bitcoin cryptocurrency ecosystem and into the dirty world of fiat currency is actually quite difficult. I think they rolled some guy that was doing money laundering, took over his accounts, and then started running their own, you know, Bitcoin to actual cash money laundering operation, and then using that to identify, you know, people who were, you know, having cash mailed to them, you know, in exchange for Bitcoin or something. Yeah, and they rounded up 35 vendors from the dark web. They got something like 90 cases going from this. So, yeah, be careful, perhaps, when you launder your Bitcoins.
Yeah, and before we move on, a big old f*** you to anyone who works at ICE who's been involved in separating kids from their families. Now, I remember years ago interviewing Roger Dingledine of the Tor Project and really talking about how Tor would make most sense sort of embedded in browsers to be used as, you know, a default setting for like private tabs. This browser, Brave, has now added Tor support to private tabs, which is, you know, what it should be used for, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, this, it does seem like a pretty smart move, and the Brave browser obviously has got a lot of you know, a lot of thought put into how to make it easier and safer to use the web in a way that kind of lines up with what people's expectations are. I think, I mean, in terms of advertising and paying for content, and yeah, in this case, private browsing. When a lot of lay people don't understand that the incognito mode or private browsing mode doesn't do much from a network point of view, and yeah, having a you know, incognito or private tab where you could just, you know, by default get Tor in this case, like it's you can turn it on whilst they're testing it, that seems pretty cool because it makes it match what people expect, which is good.
Some more Rowhammer action, Adam.
Hey, yeah, we do love Rowhammer here on the show. People have been working, research has been working on exploiting Rowhammer despite the mitigations added to the Android platform. And they've got some working local privilege escalation against modern, fully patched Android systems with modern hardware, although not completely reliable. And it does seem that it's not super clear why that's the case. Google has said, of course, that most people don't have to worry about having their RAMs hammered for privilege escalation. But yeah, if this is a reliable technique, then, you know, I would be surprised if we don't see it used.
Yeah, you really get that sense that Rowhammer exploitation in the wild is inevitable. And I still vividly recall, Adam, our first discussion about Rowhammer when it was first sort of described as a technique and, you know, just saying, wow, wouldn't it be great if this could actually get to the point where it's reliable? And it's, you know, it's just been trucking towards that destination ever since. Someone's been, oh man, this is just one of those stories that shouldn't be. Someone took a poke around Shodan looking for Elasticsearch and of course found, you know, gazillions of records of PII there. And one of them, giant blobs of data they found came from a company called Exactus. And it's one of those, like, you know, consumer reporting agencies. Yeah, data on 340 million people. I mean, yeesh.
Yeah, something like 2 terabytes of data accessible without credentials to anyone who bothers to go look on Shodan. And yeah, the rage of information, you know, is, you know, 340 million people. That's almost everybody in the US, isn't it? I think.
Well, that's more than everybody in the US.
Yeah, yes, maybe there's duplicate records. That's quite a lot. But yeah, apparently the level of detail of the data was quite, you know, quite specific in some cases. Obviously, the company makes their business aggregating information about people. So, you know, they've got quite a lot. And yeah, it's, I mean, it's one of these things where what do you do? Like, what are you supposed to do when all of this data has already been, you know, sprayed around the internet by everybody without your consent? Now, what are you supposed to do? You know, in lieu of a GDPR equivalent in the US with really, you know, huge financial fines, you know, it doesn't really seem to be much to do.
Now, Ross Ulbricht, I didn't even realize that he had another avenue for appeal, but Ross Ulbricht, I think he was trying to get a hearing in the Supreme Court, and not going to happen. He is absolutely, definitely going to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Yeah, I mean, they were making the argument that he got, you know, a longer sentence, and he got the non-parole aspect of his sentence on the basis of things that he wasn't actually tried for in court. I mean,
That's a pretty weak argument, man. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, you can see why the lawyers are working an angle because, hey, it's an angle, right? And that's their job. But yeah, it doesn't seem super convincing, I'm afraid. And yes, no. He will be in jail for a long time.
No. And I think regular listeners would know that we're not, particularly sympathetic towards Ross Ulbricht at Risky Business HQ. Oh, now here's one that's just been blowing up in the last, in the last day or so, which is, you know, stories about, oh, 2 zero-day exploits were found after someone uploaded a PDF to VirusTotal. But we reported on this months ago. I'm really curious why this is getting a second round of coverage, Adam. I think it's because details about the bugs have been released. Is that why?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm also not quite sure why this has had a second resurgence.
I think it's because they've released technical details on it, but people are jumping up and down like it's new, and it ain't.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And it goes to show there's a whole bunch of treasure to be found in VirusTotal. If you've got one of those full-featured subscriptions, then yeah, there's a lot of good stuff to be had there. And if you're an expert dev, maybe don't upload your work in progress to VirusTotal.
Good advice. We got two skateboarding dog stories this week, Adam, and this one absolutely hilarious. This is the funniest supply chain failed supply chain attack I think I've ever seen. Please tell us what it is.
Oh dear. So yes, Gentoo, the Linux distribution for people who like to put spoilers on their Linux. Somebody guessed a password for one of their developers. Found some passwords on a existing data breach. Clearly, the guy had a predictable Dan Kaminsky style password scheme. They guessed his single factor creds for GitHub. He was a member of the Gentoo organization on GitHub. Turned out that meant he had commit rights. And yes, they used his account to commit A, some racism to the page, and B, RMRFs into all of the build scripts. Now, it turns out they're not very good hackers because that doesn't actually work like that, and the RMRF they'd whacked and it just straight up didn't work. And if they had played their cards right, they could have had the code from that tree synced across into a real, git.gentoo, and onwards to owning all of the boxes. And
but does anyone, who uses Gentoo anymore?
Well, I mean, I guess there are a bunch of people that still use it. It has somewhat gone out of fashion, compiling everything from scratch. A little bit out of fashion these days. But yeah, I mean, there is a bunch of Gentoo in a lot of places. And, you shell all of those, you'd certainly have a good time.
Know, right? Like, because we saw what happened with NotPetya taking, costing the world billions and billions of dollars because companies like FedEx and, Maersk, are still running, god-awful ancient OSs. So you never know. I mean, it could have been the case that some terribly important global logistics firm is running Gentoo, and this would have been enough to cause a measurable blip in global trade because that's the world we live in now.
It absolutely could happen. It's a good reminder to everybody to think about their software supply chain. And it's, Gentoo in this, this particular skateboarding dog segment. But, it's a good time to remind everybody. We've seen all of the other Linux distributions get their supply chain owned, and none of them are in any better situation than Gentoo is. So, it's skateboarding.
Well, what I want to know, Adam, what I want to know about more than the ones that we know about are the ones that we don't know about. Because you're telling me no one's ever succeeded and there isn't, some little funny stuff in there at the moment?
Yeah, supply chain is a hell of a thing.
Do you remember Ben Hawke's talk at KiwiCon, A History of Corruption, where he was showing some of the subtlety? Some of the subtlety where you could, if you had commit rights, you could just change change some very subtle things to grant yourself great power. So let's put it that way. But
it's kind of certainly a waste of a perfectly good ownage, this particular, RMRFing everything. Did not go well. You should have done better. Like, there was lots more fun you could have had with that.
Indeed. Indeed. Now, speaking of fun, this is our second skateboarding dog this week. Samsung is investigating claims that their phones are randomly and spontaneously dispatching images from the camera roll to people in, the phone's contacts, which, depending on the ratio of junk shots to, to nice nature photography, could be pretty embarrassing for some people.
Yeah, I don't even understand how this happens. Like, the story appears to be that they rolled out some new messaging application or an update to the messaging application, and then some of the carriers have rolled it out. I think it was at T-Mobile in the US was one where most of the cases seem to be. But anyway, it was just randomly sending people images from the phone, and it didn't show up in the history as well. So, you didn't even know that you had your junk pics sent, to your mom or whoever else is in your phone, which, I don't understand how you like, how do you manage to make that happen, Samsung? Like, that's
that's an interesting one, right? Like, you do sort of sit back and go, huh, how did that happen? But I mean, I've seen some, look, I mean, I remember once using iPhoto to create a Facebook photo album, and the photos that it uploaded were not the ones I selected. And thank God there was nothing bad in there, but I was like, okay, not doing that again, you know, because that's a pretty crappy bug. And I've seen all sorts of other weird things. I think I've told this story on the show before, but once a friend of mine, he and his wife got divorced and, you know, they have kids. So one of them was round at the other person's place looking after the kids. They logged into their Facebook account using the other one's computer. And then there was some sort of cookie auth sync to their iPhone, which meant that my friend wound up being logged in to his wife's Tinder account on his phone.
Awkward.
And that was a bit of a day ruiner, let me tell you. Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. And I'm taking a break. I'm actually out of here for a couple of weeks, Adam. And then when I get back, you're off at your company retreat with your colleagues. So I think I've booked Haroon Mir to fill in for you that week. So I guess, mate, it's going to be 4 weeks until we chat again.
Yes. I hope you enjoy your holiday. And I will, I guess, we'll talk to you in the August edition of Risky Biz.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Oh, and we did get some great feedback on the Office 365 multi-factor auth thing. Like last week, Adam and I asked, the audience if it's true that Microsoft customers have to pay for two-factor authentication on Office 365. Well, listener Paul Schnackenberg wrote in to tell us that all business premium and enterprise clients can enable multi-factor authentication for all users without an extra cost. But what you don't get with the E3 and business premium licenses, but you do with the more expensive E5 licensing, is the ability to whitelist IP address ranges. So in other words, only applying MFA to logins coming from outside the organization, but you know, not from inside. And you know, with E5, you get other features as well, like risk-based access and UEBA stuff and all of that. But yeah, the long story short is if you've got business or enterprise licensing for Office 365, 2FA is free of charge. So thank you for clearing that up, Paul. Okay, so the big announcement this week is registrations for the Risky Biz Black Hat Party are now open. The party will take place the night before Black Hat commences. That's the Tuesday night, and it'll be held at Alexa's Bar at Paris Casino from 7 to 10 p.m. There's an early bird hour just for women who listen to the show. We're working with the Diana Initiative to make that a valuable networking hour. So yes, it would be great if our women listeners could come down a little bit earlier. I've dropped a link to the Eventbrite for the event into this week's show notes. And sadly, I am certain that we will run out of tickets very quickly, even though we've upped the numbers from last year. So yeah, if you're interested in going, please do hit that link now. Big thanks to our party sponsors, Signal Sciences, Remediant and Bugcrowd, and also a big thanks to our party partner, the Diana Initiative. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Melanie Ensign, a public relations professional who specializes in information security. I first met Melanie when she worked at Facebook, but these days she works over at Uber. And I guess what makes Melanie a little bit different is I've met plenty of PR agency people who work on vendor accounts for security, you know, companies. But Melanie's thing is about working in-house with companies as a specialist InfoSec PR person. So I interviewed Melanie about a couple of things. Firstly, how can security professionals best work with the PR pros in their company? Getting to know your PR pros is pretty handy if you wind up having to respond to an incident later. That's one aspect here. But also, it's a great idea to work with PR if you want to get some of your team's work and story out there into the public realm. Melanie also shares some tips on how to best deal with the media if you're going to give an interview, and here she is.
You can cover a lot of ground by proactively having conversations with your PR marketing teams before you really need something from them. Keep in mind that for most PR people, security is not their primary focus. And their remit in their role probably covers multiple things, of which security might be one, and usually doesn't pop up on the radar until something bad happens. And so it's really helpful as a security team if you can proactively engage with your PR person, not with demands or frequent requests, but if you see something that you consider to be, wow, like a really good example from the industry, the community that you would like your team to emulate, share that with your PR person and make time to talk to them about it and say, hey, I really like the way that this company responded to this incident, or I really like the way that this company is, you know, really focused on a specific mission or initiative around security. And what can we do as a company to either get ready for an incident so that we could respond in a similar way? Or what can I be doing to help you as the PR person to get the word out about some of these things that we're working on?
That actually sounds like, you know, very, very sensible advice, which is almost like, you know, teaching them, hey, you know, these are the things that are going on in our field as it applies to your job. And, you know, I just wanted to keep you in the loop on, you know, this thing that's happened to this company that could also happen to us, or this initiative that this company is getting some good mileage on because, you know, they're doing this type of research and that's helping them with recruitment. We might want to do something like that. So it's really about like,
Exactly. Yeah. One of the things that a lot of companies miss, and where I think a great inroad is, if you're trying to kind of cut through the noise with your PR team, is stop thinking about security as bad things that are going to happen, or, you know, being prepared, you know, for an incident, or even as like risk management or, you know, insurance. Like there will be a time for all of that. But if you're trying to cut through to your PR team, help them understand what your security team is doing that could actually help further the company and the brand's narrative around technical innovation.
Yeah.
So instead of just waiting for bad things to happen, if your engineers are building something really cool, or if you have a really interesting product feature, whether it's primarily for security or not, if there's a security benefit to it, there's brand value to it.
Yeah, and you want to sort of build that aura, don't you? That shiny aura of, you know, we've got people who know what they're doing working for our company. That is helpful.
Exactly. And you know what? I've had to create this job at almost every company I've been at, right? This isn't a job that just naturally exists. There aren't that many of us in the PR and communications world who are solely dedicated to things like security. And it's, you know, a very effective way for me to have these conversations with leadership teams who've never had a security PR person before, is to talk to them about the importance of the engineering excellence that's happening on the team and how it can actually help their technical and innovation story.
Which I guess, you know, for online brands, which you've had experience for, I mean, that's critically important. For other organizations, less so, but still, I take your point.
Well, I think it's critically important for the non-online companies even more so, because they're the ones that have the hardest time recruiting talent. And so, you know, I think about companies that I talk to, particularly in the Midwest here in the U.S., where they're not the sexy tech companies, and they ask like, Melly, how do I recruit talent? Because everybody's moving to California or New York.
This
and
might
like,
be
a
problem in Australia as well. Just saying.
And you know what? It's because you don't have it. You're not telling your tech story. You do have one. You don't have to be an online company or a social media company or a mobile app company to have a tech story. There are engineers working at every single company. And that is an opportunity for you to differentiate yourself, you know, from some of the other like brick and mortar companies, to be able to say like, we're, you know, perhaps we're not an online business, but we have technical experience and we have opportunities for people with technical skills.
Yeah. And look at this research we did. Where people are doing really cool stuff. I mean, I think particularly organizations in the finance sector, I mean, they're you know, notoriously tight-lipped about anything that they're doing. But just the sheer volume of good engineers working in the finance sector, you know, I'd really hope that they would listen to this and maybe try to convince management that talking about what they're doing is a positive thing for the business. Now, look,
I was just going to say a really good example of this is what the New York Times is doing. They have an entire section of their website dedicated to their engineering organization. They are very much branding themselves as a tech company.
Point well received. Look, another thing that people were curious about, you know, knowing that we were going to do this interview, and it's a question that I get a lot. I get asked a lot as well, which is people ask, you know, what are your tips for dealing with the press when maybe, you know, you might be a small company that doesn't have a PR team. You know, you've got an opportunity to sit down with a journalist and talk about something you've been doing, or maybe you're responding to some bad news story, whatever it is. I mean, people are quite justifiably nervous about surviving first contact with media. What are your tips when it comes to, you know, doing an InfoSec themed interview with media, or responding to an InfoSec themed incident?
So a couple of things to keep in mind when you first start engaging with journalists. The first is, know why you're having the conversation with a particular reporter. Don't sit down and just start talking for no reason, right? If you're doing an interview about a new product that you're launching, make sure you really know what it is that you want to talk about. Even if you're going to be an off-the-record source for a reporter, don't just willy-nilly wing it in terms of, I'm not really sure why we're having this conversation, right? You need to make sure, at least within your own mind, that you understand what the purpose of the conversation is. Second of all, just keep in mind that reporters don't work for you, nor should they, right? Many of us who work with reporters that we still consider to be the free press, you know, they don't work for us, and we shouldn't want them to work for us. They have their own goals and their own agendas, which is important to understand in terms of where they're coming from when they sit down and have a conversation with you, but also setting realistic expectations. If you're going to be a source for a reporter, or if you're only going to ask them to write fluffy pieces about your company, you're probably not going to get the result that you want.
No. Bring something valuable.
And I think that's important. I see a lot on InfoSec Twitter where people get really upset about things that are published. And, you know, first of all, if you think a story is really bad, or if you think it's rubbish, stop linking to it on social media. The more you share it, the more traffic it drives. And then there's definitely no way that an editor is going to change it. So that's issue number one. Don't send traffic to the bad stories. But number two, I see people complain about, oh, I can't believe they said that after I did this 20-minute interview and they didn't quote me at all. Well, if you didn't say anything interesting, of course they didn't quote you. So again, you have to be mindful of what's the purpose of the conversation, and have that in the back of your mind before you speak to a reporter. And the last thing that I will note, and we can dig into more details on this as well, because it does touch on some of the metrics that are used by PR teams, but don't talk about things if you don't have skin in the game, right? If you don't have a perspective, if you don't have experience, if you don't actually know the details of what's happening, just getting quoted in a story can actually backfire on you.
Oh yeah. Melanie, let me just jump in there. That is actually my number one tip. All right. Is because I've done some media training for people before, and you do those, you know, practice interviews, and you know, the first thing you'll do as, you know, in a mock interview is try to get people to start swimming outside of their lane. And it's very easy as an interviewer to get people onto that mushy ground where they start talking about things that they really don't know much about, you know, and that's where 90% of the problems are.
Yep, absolutely. And again, like I said, a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of PR teams are still using outdated and somewhat antiquated metrics in terms of, you know, I want to prove my value by getting as many mentions in the media as possible, right? As if the volume of coverage somehow means something. And as a result, they're pushing their spokespeople into conversations that they really don't belong in.
Yes, that is absolutely right. And, you know, it just really is the case that stick with what you know. And there's nothing wrong with saying to a journalist, I don't really feel like I'm qualified to answer that question, or I don't really know enough about that. That's fine. And I think people just have this, they feel this pressure. They put it on themselves mostly, and it's quite normal. You know, it's not a criticism, but they sort of feel the urge to answer questions that they really shouldn't. And, you know, just be aware of that. I think that's good advice.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't think that it's always necessarily, you know, reporters really trying to push you out of your lane, although sometimes that happens. Sometimes it's a reporter who really doesn't understand the subject matter, and that's the purpose of the conversation, is for them to learn from you who has more experience. And so if they're asking a question that seems out of the blue or seems disconnected, take a step back and help them understand the context, right? And again, that's just, you know, that comes with practice, being able to actually master your conversational skills like that. And, you know, if you have a really good PR team, hopefully they're teaching you these skills as you go through interview after interview after interview, and increasingly putting you in situations where you have to stretch your skills a little bit more.
All right, Melanie Ensign, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about, you know, how people can better work with their PR teams and, you know, and help us out with some tips for people who might be a bit nervous about speaking to the press. It's been very interesting.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great time.
That was Melanie Ensign there. Big thanks to her for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay, the Chief Technology Officer of Senatas, the Australian company. Now, Senatas actually has a pretty wild history. They've been around for about 20 years now after being born in the dot-com era. And Senatas was one of a handful of dot-com companies that were bundled together and reverse listed onto the Australian Stock Exchange. Now, of course, the dot-com bubble blew up. The other companies died, but Senatas always made or raised just enough money to keep going. And that all changed in 2013 after the Snowden revelations. Suddenly, well-made Layer 2 encryptors, which are Senatas's core product, they became a hot item, and the company experienced some very, very healthy growth after that and are now in a fantastic position. And they're selling an increasingly wide range of encryption technology. Their flagship item is a 100 gigabit per second full line rate Layer 2 encryptor. It took a while to get market adoption, but I'm led to believe that it's now selling quite well. But the thing is, networks are changing these days. And Senatas has been an appliance vendor for 20 years. And now technologies like software-defined networking and SD-WAN, which is a subset of SDN, they're coming along and changing the way everyone's approaching networking and thus, you know, network-based encryption. The days of hauling all your data back to company data centers to throw everything through one or a handful of gateways, those days are numbered. And that is changing the game for Senatas. I mean, they're still going to sell a lot of 100 gigabit per second encryptors, but CPE equipment is changing, networks are changing, and everything has to be SD-WAN friendly these days. So Senatas's answer to this is what they're calling transport-independent encryption, and Julian Fay joined me to explain. Here he is.
So actually, we've been around for 20 years. Last November, we celebrated our 20th anniversary. And as you said, it's been an interesting history, but we've always sort of had a specialization, which is focusing on very high-speed encryption, predominantly at the data link layer, layer two. And as you said, pre-Snowden, that was a very specialized business. We were selling predominantly to governments and defense organizations around the world. And that was a good business, up some good years and some bad years, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, we were pretty proud of some of the technology we built. We built the first 10 gig SONET encryptor that was widely used by U.S. defense forces, and still hundreds of those in use today. But then definitely since Edward Snowden came out, and we've just talked about this before, I think it really raised the awareness in the market and the maturity level for people adopting encryption, which has, as you said, sort of really transformed the business.
Yeah, and so you've had a wonderful, you know, 5 years or so with that. But now when we look at the types of projects people are rolling out, I mean, software-defined networking started picking up buzz a few years ago as something that might actually happen, but it really feels like this year it's turned into one of those inevitable trends that's going to be the thing, right?
Yeah, so one thing that's become very apparent to us over the last couple of years is that whilst we've seen this huge innovation and disruption in the way that network services are delivered, particularly around enterprise connectivity, there hasn't really been any innovation in encryption for many years, really decades. I mean, IPsec is more than 20 years old. MACsec is more than 10 years old. And we still have these single point solutions that operate in one particular way. They, you know, they tunnel everything over layer three, or they do layer two encryption, but they're not application aware. They're not really adapted to the underlying network delivery service.
No, you sort of need to architect your whole network with these really weird little choke points and funnels, and it's all a bit, you know, there has to be a better way, right?
Exactly. And it became very apparent, particularly when we were looking at the applications for virtual encryption, that if you wanted to fit into these modern environments, then you needed a different approach. So take something like SD-WAN, software-defined WAN, which is a technology that's really shaken up, I think, the way organizations manage their branch office connectivity. So in a traditional enterprise network environment, environment, you would basically backhaul all of your branch offices over a carrier MPLS network back to the headquarters or to the enterprise data center. Through the gateway, exactly, where you'd have a single point of control. You know, you'd probably put a next-gen firewall in there. You might consider using a cloud security service like Zscaler or something like that, but basically it all goes through that choke point. But today, when so many enterprise applications are delivered as public cloud SaaS offerings, putting everything through that backhaul network really doesn't make sense. It has performance around bandwidth and around latency, and it's causing a lot of pain. So SD-WAN was really a technology that was adopted to address that problem. And it's a very simple idea. It basically says, well, instead of doing this single backhaul to this choke point, why don't we take advantage of other underlying network capabilities such as broadband internet, cellular access, etc. And what you want to do is you want to manage all of those through a single pane of glass. And depending upon the business policy and the type of traffic, we send traffic where it needs to go, when it needs to go, with appropriate levels of security, and hopefully get much better performance. So you move up, you have a sophisticated controller back at the customer premise edge. And typically these days, that's some sort of generic x86 white box. And you replace your traditional pizza box stack of appliances that will do routing and IDS and IPS and firewall and encryption, etc. And you run those as some sort of software service chain inside that x86 white box. But then the question is, what happens to security in that model? Because you've basically taken all of your traffic off this central point of control with very sophisticated firewalling and security services onto public broadband links with greater levels of exposure into the public cloud. And you need to work out what is the security requirements that you have to deliver those services across that. And of course, it's a complex situation because there are no formal standards for SD-WAN. Every provider and every enterprise takes a slightly different approach.
So, you know, where does that leave us, right? I don't even need to ask the questions. You've just asked them yourself.
So, obviously, you're going to have some form of encryption if you're sending sensitive enterprise data over corporate public into broadband internet or cellular. But the problem is that you're going to have different traffic going over different network paths with different assurance requirements and different performance needs. So if you just stick an IPsec application gateway in there, then you basically everything's going to have the same tunneling. It's going to have exactly the same overheads when it's delivered across the network. And it isn't really suited to, it's not efficient in terms of the underlying transport. So that traffic that's going over a carrier MPLS or layer 2 MPLS service is still being encrypted in a heavyweight way with an IPsec tunnel. And we thought there was a better way of addressing this problem. And we've come up with a concept that we're calling transport independent encryption. And the idea is really very simple. It simply says that instead of having a one approach suits all solution, why can't your encryption product actually adapt itself so that it better integrates with the underlying environment, meaning that you encrypt traffic at the appropriate layer where it needs to go? So what I mean by that is that some traffic may be encrypted at layer 2 because it has the lowest overhead and the best performance. That's perhaps being backhauled across a carrier, VPLS, layer 2 service or
back to a data corporate center. HQ or whatever. And then you want it assigning a different type of encryption back to stuff that you've got in the public cloud, like some sort of corporate asset in AWS.
Exactly. So if you're going over broadband internet, you can't use layer 2 encryption. You have to do it at layer 3. So
and you're going to manage this. You're going to manage this through some sort of, you know, either virtual, you know, appliance or, you know, one RU pizza box at every branch. And then control it centrally.
Exactly. So the challenges are scale and deployment. You need to be able to deploy this centrally with policies so you can basically have a zero-touch configuration and just push it out with the appropriate policies. But you also need to be able to do it in such a way that you can deploy it to tens, hundreds, and thousands of instances without having a lot of management overhead.
So how does that play out with visibility concerns, though? Because, you know, a major advantage of hauling everything back to a single gateway or, you know, a handful of gateways is you can do stuff like IDS and deep packet inspection. So, you know, how do you get around that? What's your answer to that?
So we're doing a couple of things. One is we've basically got an encryption model that allows you to encrypt at layer 2, 3, or 4, depending on your needs. So what I mean by that is you can leave the layer 2 header in the clear, encrypt the entire Ethernet payload. You can leave the Ethernet header and the IP header in clear and just encrypt the IP payload, or you can leave the layer 4 headers in clear and start your encryption further down the packet stack. And the more that you expose the packet, obviously there are security implications of that, but that does facilitate network monitoring. So we've got clients who need to do NetFlow, JFlow type monitoring of layer 4 traffic as it goes across the network, and they would need to use layer 4 encryption to allow them to continue to do that, for example. So the idea is to have a flexible policy that meets whatever the underlying assurance, monitoring, and performance needs are of your network, not a one-size-fits-all. So the point is you've removed the central location for all corporate security. So you need to sort of think about what is the holistic approach to security in this environment, which obviously includes all of the typical security controls, firewall, IDS, et cetera. So what we're seeing is that some of the vendors, and again, there are no standards for this, are building it into their SD-WAN solution. So they might have a simple stateful firewall for the public internet-facing traffic, but some of the more sensitive corporate traffic will still go back through that backhaul network. So it goes through the single port of control with far more sophisticated mechanisms. So it's really, you know, it's a holistic approach that needs to be adapted to meet the underlying needs.
Well, it sure does, right? Because you're opening up a whole bunch of egress points, which means you're going to need to be doing much more heavy monitoring per branch, right? Instead of just looking at one logical VLAN, you know, all of a sudden you've got a lot more gateways to monitor. Have you had pushback on that concept because of that?
Not really. I mean, it is kind of structural to the whole SD-WAN proposition and security. Yeah. So, I mean, that technology does require you to think differently about the way that you approach security, which is why, as you said, the central orchestration and monitoring of that traffic is so critical. And we're seeing lots of different approaches in the market from different vendors. Some of them have got them built in. There's a burgeoning security virtual network function market as well, where you plug in different appliances on the edge to do that and help it, and then they report back to a centralized controller. So there's different ways of approaching the solution, but it does require kind of rethinking the traditional enterprise security architecture, I think.
But I mean, you know, you hit on something pretty key there, which is, you know, capturing NetFlow, JFlow, whatever, right? Like network metadata these days is basically as useful as DPI. You know, I mean, if anything, like starting with NetFlow instead of DPI is going to give you a better result, because so much of, you know, what attackers do is now invisible to deep packet inspection. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, you know, either you, from a security perspective, you can monitor all that on the endpoint and then report back to a centralized controller, which isn't ideal in many respects, or you've got the problem of what do you need to put back through the choke point, and what can you do from the multiple cloud deployments where all this traffic's going. So, yeah, it's tricky.
It's tricky. So when are you actually going to start shipping something along these lines? And is this something you're doing in partnership with SD-WAN, you know, company? Like, what does this look like?
Yeah, so we've just launched a virtual network encryption appliance called CV1000. Which we've launched, and that will have this transport independent capability built into it. And we will actually be adding it as an additional capability to our hardware appliances at the end of the year as well. And that'll be available through a simple firmware upgrade. But we're also partnering with some of the vendors in the SD-WAN space, in particular an organization called ADVA, who have got a universal CPE operating system. So they basically have an operating system that is designed to run on a customer edge appliance, a PC, a white box. It's based on OpenStack, and they've integrated our transport independent encryption into that product natively, so that whatever SD-WAN vendors can run on top of their platform, that's a third-party organization, it will natively benefit from the transport independent encryption, and you'll get a consistent approach to deployment and security across that environment. And that's a product called ConnectGuard that they've recently launched.
Now, I understand that your 100 gigabit per second, you know, full line rate encryptors, they were delayed. They were launched a little later than you expected them to, but now I understand they're selling quite well. My question is, I mean, that's something that you can't replicate with software, right? But I'm wondering if you're expecting to see the software side of the Senetas business kind of eat the hardware side, at least from a revenue share point of view. Do you think that's gonna happen?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that we're always asking ourselves inside. And it's probably fair to say there's a variety of views even inside Senetas about that.
You're look, right.
as you can imagine, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
So look, I mean, we come from a 20-year heritage of building purpose-built security appliances that have got heavy tamper and anti-probing barriers built into them and are certified at FIPS Level 3. So that's, you know, we come from that perspective, and I think there is always going to be a requirement for that level of physical security and all that, and that level of performance.
And I agree, but I mean, the market for this other stuff is bigger, right? And that's why I'm curious to see what that's going to do to the revenue split.
Yeah, Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see. The jury is out, I think.
The jury is out, and I'm guessing that this is a topic of robust discussion within the offices of Senatas.
It is very robust, and I guess we won't know for a couple of years when we can talk about it more.
yeah. All right. Well, Julian Fay, thank you very much for joining us to talk about what you're doing in response to it turning into a software defined network world. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Thanks, Pat. Good to speak as always. Cheers.
That was Julian Fay of Senatas there. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be publishing a Snake Oilers podcast and a Soapbox podcast while I'm away on vacation somewhere tropical. Very nice. And I'll be back with another weekly show in 3 weeks from today. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.